This is a cycling podcast coverage of the 2025 Vuelta a España, proudly supported by Lloyds. This time next week, there'll be two world-class stage races to watch because the opening stage of the Lloyds Tour of Britain takes place on Tuesday, September the 2nd. The race will roll out from Woodbridge as Stage 1 takes the riders through the delightful Suffolk countryside to Southwold, where the stage will finish on North Parade, close to the pier and the beach. Southwold is famous for its long history in brewing beer and was also home to George Orwell for many years. But who will be toasting success and writing their name into the Lloyds Tour of Britain history books by pulling on the first green leader's jersey of the race? If you live nearby, maybe you fancy going to watch the race, and you can find a detailed race route on the British Cycling website. Head out onto the roadside to cheer on the riders, then tune into the cycling podcast sponsored by Lloyds. Lloyds, there at every stage. Now it's over to Daniel in Spain.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2025 Vuelta a España, celebrating 10 years of the cycling podcast on the ground every day at the Grand Tours.
Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
Michel Pellachy. Hein?
Bonsoir, Daniele.
Excellent. Michele. Well, that was a French greeting. Mm-hmm. But you can hear, hopefully the listeners can hear in the background some Spanish music being played, live music tonight. We've got Pellachy. Did you order this? Did you organize this musical accompaniment for tonight's podcast?
I got this free. We are on a marchapiede.
A pavement.
Right in front of the Église Saint-Bruno in Voiron, France. So I can speak really, French all day long.
Yeah, wonderful.
We're having a beer. We're having a good time here. Great day. Weather-wise.
A great day. Well, excellent weather. We didn't have such a good day in the car, though, did we, Pellachy? Because we were transitioning countries. We were changing countries today. We were going, of course, from Italy. Italy feels a long way away. All of a sudden, we were sort of stocking up on all kinds of Italian products before we crossed into France via the Fréjus tunnel. Unfortunately, that proved to be a little bit of a long journey and a pretty annoying journey, didn't it? Because we were stuck at the mouth of the Fréjus tunnel, as a lot of the convoy for the race, or certainly those people not on the race route but following the race around, were for a long time today. But we got here in the end, and we saw a pretty exciting finale. I would suggest, Pellachy, maybe exciting for the wrong reasons, because there was a lot of road furniture, it was pretty sketchy, it was pretty dangerous, and I'm just glad, I may be wrong, but I don't think there were any serious crashes. I'm pretty sure there weren't any serious crashes in the last few kilometers. There were a couple of riders who had gone down before that, George Bennett, we know that he was one of them. But yes, it felt like a bit of an accident waiting to happen with all that road furniture, didn't it, Pellachy?
It did. It was a finale full of twists and turns. The road narrowed a lot. But we're here in Voiron with an unexpected winner as well. What can we say? We're pretty.
Well, we can spoiler the stage winner already. We can say that the stage was won by Ben Turner. We're going to hear a lot more about that victory later on. A surprise victor, won because it was his first Grand Tour stage win, but also because he wasn't supposed to be at the Vuelta a España. He got a last-minute call-up. A week ago, he was in Belgium at the Renewi Tour. Yep. And as far as he was concerned, he was going to finish that race. But he got the last-minute call because, I was going to say, Lewis Hamilton. That's not Lewis Hamilton, is it, Pellachy?
Lucas.
Lucas Hamilton. Not the Formula One driver, but the Ineos Grenadiers Australian climber. He fell sick before the Vuelta a España, which resulted in Ben Turner being called up. Pellachy, Voiron, we're in, just outside the suburbs of Grenoble. And I noticed as we drove into Voiron, there was one of those signs which tells you which other towns around Europe this place is twinned with. I noticed it is twinned with Bassano del Grappa.
Oh no!
A place that I'm very fond of. Of course, there's a rider from Bassano del Grappa racing in this Vuelta a España, Marco Frigo, someone you know very well.
I do, and it's not a coincidence maybe that we are in France now and the French rider is leading this race. Saltbe has put on the maillot rojo for the first time.
Indeed, indeed. And Pelacci, well, that's a nice cue for us to go back to this morning, back to Italy. And the general classification, of course, was finally poised because we had Jonas Vingegaard in the maillot rojo leading the Vuelta a España. He was on the same time as David Gaudu. We wondered how this was going to pan out. Well, we had a strong suspicion that David Gaudu would be fairly happy to relinquish that red jersey, and all that Salt Bae David Gaudu needed to do was finish a few places ahead of Jonas Vingegaard in what we thought was probably going to be a big bunch finish today, and so it proved. But let's go back to this morning and let's just hear briefly how Salt Bae, how David Gaudu was feeling about the day ahead, and also Jonas Vingegaard. Well, there was a bit of time for him to make a few light-hearted comments about the events of yesterday and the bike theft. In fact, I had an interesting message today, Pelacci, from a listener who is a barrister. And he sort of, I don't know whether he was pulling me up, but I certainly didn't take it that way. I took it as an informative message telling me the legal difference between theft, robbery, and burglary. So this is a sort of a linguistic point as well. Let me just see if I can find that. Pelacci. Yes, Pelacci, here it is. This was from Max Pietras. For your information, he says, theft is taking another's property dishonestly. Burglary is entering premises, residential or commercial, as trespasser and stealing or intending to steal. Robbery is stealing and using or threatening violence in order to. So break into an unoccupied team bus and stealing bikes is theft. So we shall refer to it as theft. Anyway, to go back to what I was originally saying, Jonas Vingegaard had a few light-hearted comments about the theft yesterday. And I also asked him, because I was curious, and maybe I just missed this, maybe this has already been reported, but the pictures we saw posted and I think taken by his coach Tim Hemske, or one of the coaches at Visma Lisa Bike, from before this Vuelta a España, of Vingegaard training. Remember, he was training in that gilet, just the gilet with no, didn't look as though he was wearing any socks. I didn't know where that was and exactly what kind of training camp he'd had before this Vuelta a España. So I asked him about that as well. So we're going to hear from Salt Bae, David Gaudu, winner yesterday, of course, and Jonas Vingegaard this morning in Susa.
Yeah, for sure it can be an objective for today, but the big objective is to be safe to the finish line. I win yesterday, okay, the red jersey can be the best thing as possible today, but we want to put all in the battle for it. We want just to be safe today with the bench sprint. Tomorrow is a big day with the team time trial, so we will see during the stage what we can do.
To be honest, I haven't heard any news. I knew that yesterday I had at least three bikes to ride on. Of course, on the way back to the hotel, we were looking if we could see some of the Cervelos riding on the road already, but no. Yeah, no, we... Yeah, of course, the police is doing a good job. They're looking for the bikes, I guess, and doing some research there. So yeah, it's... We have the bikes we need, and I think maybe they got a new shipment as well.
Yeah, it's just a quick one. We saw a lot of videos of you training in the month before the Vuelta with Tim Hemskirk, I think. Can you just tell us where that was and about what were you focusing on in those weeks? Because it's obviously difficult to negotiate a month between the Tour and the Vuelta.
Yeah, of course, you cannot really do a lot between the Tour and the Vuelta. It's a very short period, so I was training in Annecy. It's a very nice area. Good weather, nice mountains, so yeah, for training it's optimal, and I was there together with Tim, and he supported me, and the team supported me, so I had a good period, more trying to keep it as it is rather than
So there you go, Pelacci. Vingegaard was heading into territory, well, close to territory he knows very well, because as we heard there, he's been training near Annecy, and that's a place that he goes often. I don't know whether he owns an apartment there, but it's certainly somewhere that he's referred to in the past. Him and his family are very fond of it. So that is where he's been preparing for the Vuelta a España. Didn't give many details away there, but he did talk about the fact that the last month for him has been about trying to maintain as much of the condition from the Tour de France as possible, rather than sort of relaxing and trying to build back up again. Well, let's find out how he got on today, shall we? Because it is time for today's Hammonometro.
El Jamonómetro de Michele Pelacci.
Pelacci, how many hams for today's stage? Bearing in mind we're talking jambon now, not prosciutto.
It needs to be two slices of jamon again, pretty cheap prosciutto. Please don't label me as too harsh, but I have to say it was an El Pozo budget type of stage with not much action once again until the last kilometer, the very end of the stage.
Well, let's find out what happened, Pelacci, because we didn't know this morning, did we? We thought, we suspected that the little trek might make things very hard for Jasper Philipsen, maybe make mincemeat of Philipsen on those early climbs. However, that was not the case. But tell us what did happen.
Again, we had a pretty weak breakaway up the road in the first kilometers of the race. Mario Aparicio, Camille Benoit, Joël Nicolau, Sean Quinn and Luis Vervaeke attacked the Montginevro climb with a 3-minute gap. The riders accumulated more King of the Mountain points on the Puerto Exiles, Montginevro and Lotaré. It was Joël Nicolau of Caja Rural who will wear the polka dot jersey tomorrow. Sean Quinn tried...
That's appropriate, is it not? Because you not tell me that he is the rider from the northernmost point, so northeasternmost point in this Vuelta a España, Catalan rider. Yep. Basically, the rider in this Vuelta a España closest to where the time trial is going to be taking place tomorrow.
You're very right. Sean Quinn tried to go solo, just like he did yesterday. The peloton caught everyone. Mario Aparicio tried to go again. Sinuhe Fernandez, our friend, whose name comes from a crazy Egypt novel, tried to. Not much to be gained in these actions. A complete peloton got to Noyarey. I probably have the Spanish pronunciation in this French town, but the intermediate sprint was there and was won by Mads Pedersen. With 31k to go, Bruno Armirail tried a late attack. He was caught as well. As the stage got closer and closer to Voiron, as we said, the roads narrowed. A couple of tricky corners caused a crash at the back of the peloton. Jay Vine and Georges Bennett went down, among others.
You put a nice French twist on Georges Bennett. George. I like that.
It all ended up in a sprint with that slight uphill to make things a little more interesting. And just like yesterday, the smartest guy won. Ben Tourneur.
Voilà.
Ben Tourneur of Ineos raised his hands in Voiron.
He did, Pelacci. Surprising everyone. Certainly surprising. What's surprising? Jasper Philipsen. We'll find out in a minute what Jasper Philipsen made of it all. But, Pelacci, first things first, let's give the rundown of who finished where. Turner won that sprint, Philipsen second. Edward Plankas. So Jasper Philipsen's lead out man, effectively, he was third. That probably tells you that something didn't quite work the way it should have for Alpecin. Ethan Vernon of Israel Premier Tech was fourth. Jente Beermans of Arkea, they were very prominent in the last few kilometers. He was fifth. Mads Pedersen, a disappointed Mads Pedersen, he was sixth. Fabio Christen was seventh. Luis Aular of Movistar was eighth. And Guillermo Silva, the Uruguayan from Caja Rural, was ninth. And Burati of Bahrain Victorious was tenth. Now, Pelacci, let's just scan these results and look for Salt Bay. David Gaudu was 25th, and Jonas Vingegaard, well, I'm going to tell you that Jonas Vingegaard was 42nd, in fact. So comfortably enough, sufficient places behind David Gaudu to give Salt Bay David Gaudu the red jersey. Incidentally, before I forget, Pelacci, I did ask Salt Bay this morning why he didn't do the Salt Bay celebration when he won yesterday, and he said, well, I didn't think of it, I didn't have time. But it sounded as though that if he gets the opportunity again, we might well see that. And who knows, because he's in excellent form.
Pelacci? He put some salt on his Vuelta with his Mayor Rojo, but I mean, probably it's unfair to say that Vingegaard slammed on his brake to arrive 42nd, but it's worth mentioning a thing that he was the third Visma Lisa Bike member at the finish line. Probably they were not too focused on keeping the jersey.
Pelacci, On general classification, David Gourdou now leads, with Jonas Vingegaard still on the same time. Giulio Ciccone is third, 8 seconds down. Egan Bernal still 14 seconds down. Tom Pidcock leads the pack. A lot of riders, 16 seconds down. We've talked, haven't we, in the last few days about the few, very few GC riders who have already lost more significant time. Antonio Tiberi has been the main one. He's 27th. At 35 seconds down. In the points competition, there were changes there today. Mads Pedersen now leads the points competition. He's 2 points ahead of Ethan Vernon, and just 1 point behind Vernon is Jasper Philipsen, and that's already shaping up to be a hotly contested competition this year. You mentioned Nicolau in the King of the Mountains jersey from Caja Rural. Just talking about the jerseys, because again, I may forget this later. If you're wondering what the reasons might be for Vingegaard wanting to relinquish the red jersey, given that tomorrow is a team time trial, you might be asking, well, is there not an advantage to going last, as Vingegaard would be if he was leading the general classification? Well, there could be, but there's also a bit of a disadvantage in the sense that he wouldn't be able to wear his normal skin suit, would he? And at the Tour de France, remember, we heard that Tadej Pogacar, on the night of the first individual time trial, the night before, he declined to be measured up by Santini, isn't it, who does the yellow jerseys at the Tour de France, because it's quite time consuming. And he just said, use my measurements from last year. But ordinarily, this is a process that can take half an hour at a team hotel in the evening. So who knows, maybe that may have been the main reason why Vingegaard didn't want to keep the red jersey.
The same manufacturers are doing the jersey for the Vuelta as well. We'll see. We'll talk about tomorrow's stage.
Actually, he probably got his measurements, because he had the King of the Mountains jersey. Did he? He probably rode one of the prize jerseys for a time trial at the Tour. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he didn't, actually. Anyway, Pelacci, I think that rounds things up. Some interesting reactions at the finish line. One in particular. First of all, we're going to hear from Jasper Philipsen. We're talking to Eurosport TNT's reporter Anders Mielke and a few of us who were also gathered around reflecting on his second place. Pretty unhappy, Jasper Philipsen. Unhappy with the way his legs felt anyway. And then an emotional, very emotional, Michał Kwiatkowski, who did an incredible job leading out Ben Turner for the last 4 kilometres, really. And this was a bit of a repeat of what Kwiatkowski did for Turner at the Tour of Poland just a couple of weeks ago. And Pelacci, well, I was drawn to Kwiatkowski immediately because I'd seen the job that he'd done, but I also saw him leaning over his handlebars a few seconds after he'd crossed the line, and you could see that tears were already pouring from his eyes. So I made my way over and asked him exactly why he was so emotional. So we're going to hear now from Jasper Philipsen and Michał Kwiatkowski.
Yeah, we did a really good job with the team. Also, Edward was super strong, and I wanted to launch from the left, but yeah, he didn't hear me. With all the spectators, was also still far out, and then I lost a bit of speed and momentum. But yeah, for us, Edward was really strong, and I also didn't have the best legs.
Did you feel that you could have done something differently?
Yeah. Also, the line wasn't completely straight, so of course that makes it a bit more difficult to pass. But yeah, we have to analyze. But I also know that my feeling is not great at all. But yeah, I was not feeling good enough, and had the legs speech.
It was an unreal feeling, because you know, we're coming with a lot of pressure to the final, and I kind of lost Ben. 6K to go, I almost crashed in the cup, and I said on the radio that he's on his own from that on. But I managed to get back, and to finish that off, a sprint from him is just incredible. You know, we're not the main favorites for the sprint, but you know, if he just had, and good job, man.
Way to go, man.
If you do the things right and you keep believing, you can do it. So, well, it's the lesson for everyone that, you know, never give up and always believe you can win.
Michał, in those tears, is there a bit of what you've been through over the last few months and how hard you've had to work to get back here?
I've got the feeling that I'm going through the tears on every single race at the minute, and I'm just so happy for winning every race. Doesn't matter if it's me or my teammate. I know how hard it is on that level, and especially on the Grand Tour, you know, to win a sprint like this. And for me, after such a long coming back, I'm back at my top, and I just feel so much satisfaction, you know.
And just last one, was the making of this victory, was it also sort of last night when you reflected on, well, Filippo went for the sprint yesterday, yeah, and rather than Ben, and was there sort of a decision made on the basis of that it would be Ben today?
No, I mean, like, we always have to take a decision on the road. It depends how the guys are feeling, and obviously after each individual stage we've got our capture, and you know, we're discussing what went good, what went wrong, what we can improve. And today's result just proves we're just doing the right thing. The most important is, like, you know, we have a great morale, great spirit in the team. And, you know, with that, it's easy to, you know, do the tweaks and just improve, because nobody is really taking anything personal. And we know that the ultimate goal is to win Vuelta and win the stages. So, yeah, we go for it.
Flooring anniversary sale. We're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices with beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's anniversary sale. Right.
Well, Palachi, the music continues. I think the music is from a band from Tarragona. I mentioned the twinning, the fact that Voiron is twinned with Bassano de Grappa. There was some, and I must guiltily admit, I didn't read the leaflets. We get bombarded with leaflets. We get inundated with leaflets every day in the press room. So there was something about some kind of arrangement with Tarragona. Mm. So I think the band that's playing some very nice, very atmospheric Spanish music on the church steps about 100 metres away. Yeah. I think they may be from Tarragona. Palachi, that was a nice interview with Michał Kwiatkowski. Just to add a bit of context to that, I referred to his the problems that he's had this year and whether that was one reason why he was so emotional. He was out for long periods of this year. He's had a lot of knee problems. Hmm. I don't think just this year, but going back a couple of years now. And I mentioned Poland. Well, there were echoes of what happened in Poland today, because there as well, on that stage that Ben Turner won, the third stage, Kwiatkowski had crashed earlier on in the stage, and he thought he was out of it. He thought he wouldn't be able to help Turner, and he came back and he duly did help him. And similarly today, as we just heard, he sort of lost Turner with a few kilometres to go, and again he thought he was out of it and Turner would have to look after himself. But no, we watched together, didn't we, Palachi? Watched the replay of the moment with sort of 3.8 kilometres to go, where Kwiatkowski appeared on the far right-hand side of the road. Kwiatkowski's always been a rider, going back to the days when he was first riding the Tour de France for Quickstep, I think, at the time, maybe Etics, I think it was Quickstep, in about 2010. It would have been 2013, I guess, that sort of period. And when he was doing a job in the lead-out train for Mark Cavendish, he always used to make me nervous, Palachi, because he was always looking over his shoulder. But I think the reality is and was that he's one of the rare riders who at 55 kilometres an hour in a very chaotic finale has the kind of coolness and the ability on the bike to be able to do that, to sort of look over his shoulder and look around, because most riders can't.
I must admit, the legs as well, because today's finish was slightly uphill. So I think in the last 5K, there was a total of 70 meters gained in elevation, which is not much. It's probably like 2% average. You still need the legs to go at 50K per hour on that gradient. So
if there was 70K, if there was 70K uphill on one of our morning runs, I'd be looking to drop you there, Palachi. just FYI, for the record.
Tomorrow will be brutal for us, but no, Kwiatkowski, he was alone. Yeah. We couldn't see Ganna, couldn't see any other Ineos Grenadiers teammates. Meanwhile, other teams had multiple teammates. Other sprinters had, for example, Jasper Philipsen was able to have Plankaert just for the last run up to the lead out on the sprint. Yeah, Kwiatkowski, wonderful job all alone.
Well, and you mentioned Ganna, and I think we heard in that interview my question to Kwiatkowski about whether what happened today and this victory was sort of born out of as well what hadn't worked yesterday. Because this morning, I actually asked someone from Ineos Grenadiers, how come Turner hadn't sprinted yesterday? Because having seen him win in Poland and having seen him ride very well over the last few weeks, particularly on sort of uphill sprints, it occurred to me that yesterday would have been a good opportunity for him. But no, it was Ganna that was the anointed one yesterday, and it didn't seem to go too well. I'm not sure where Ganna was in the finale today, but Turner's interesting because he seems to be coming. You know, you get these riders who, over the course of a career, they sort of are transformed, or they take on a new role, or almost by accident they discover that they have abilities that they weren't maybe credited with at the start of their career. And it feels to me as though Ben Turner is kind of inching further and further towards bunch sprinter kind of territory.
Interesting, but I must admit that twisty and turny finale was also peculiar in a sense that positioning was key. And being the smartest, and again, just like yesterday, not the one with the strongest leg, was more important. For example, we sort of analyzed together how Mats Pedersen entered the penultimate corner in great position. He was third. But then what happened was that he found himself on the right side of the road when the Alpecin train for Philipsen was coming up the road via the right side. So he was not with. He was not ready on that moment to jump on the right train at the right moment. Who was super smart? Ben Turner.
And it's interesting with Little Trek that we've talked about their limited resources for Mats Pedersen in this Vuelta a España. We know that they've got Chicone here and they're going for stage victories, but they've had to sort of spread their resources. And Pedersen nominally only has two other guys. He has Hola and Søren Krav Andersen. And the way that Little Trek have decided to deploy those two, well, Hola, we saw him sort of leading Pedersen into the finale for a long time, doing a really good job. Krav Andersen was being used as a sweeper on Pedersen's wheel. And when the road narrowed with 2 kilometers to go, Krav Andersen lost the wheel and he found himself very quickly 15 wheels back, and he couldn't, it was impossible in the space of 2 kilometers to get back up and do the job that he needed to do for Pedersen. Pedersen at the finish said, I think Pelacci, you heard him say to our Danish colleagues, that he was lacking one man today. I thought, if you told me this morning that Mads Pedersen wouldn't win and he would be saying that at the finish today, I would have imagined that it was because his team had pulled very hard early in the day to try and get rid of Jasper Philipsen. That wasn't the case. They decided there was a sort of marriage of convenience today with Alpecin. Both teams decided to work together. They didn't, on the Mont-Genèvre and the Lourdes, they didn't try to get rid of Philipsen.
Yep.
But nonetheless, Pedersen did find himself a little bit short of resources in the last couple of kilometres. Philipsen, interesting to hear him say that he's not feeling particularly good, or he certainly didn't feel good today, because we know that he's not going to have that many opportunities, so everyone really counts for him. A few other things I noticed in the finale, Pelacci, Salt Bay, David Gourdou, we talked about what help those various riders, Pedersen, Philipsen had. Gourdou was well protected, but in the last couple of kilometres, he also took some risks as well to make sure that he was where he needed to be. And what you can see, if you go back and watch the aerial shot of that finale, you can also see how well he's riding at the moment and what kind of explosiveness he's got in his legs, because it's only riders with great form are able to move up the way that he did in those last couple of kilometres.
I have also to mention the fact that in one of the cadute, the chutes. Mm. How is it in French? Chutes?
Chute. Chute. À l'arrière du peloton.
Exactly, that we mentioned before. A couple of teammates of Mats Pedersen, they were caught behind. I think it was Gebrezabie. Probably Gebrezabie pulled the whole day, so was not able to help Mats Pedersen a lot. But Carlos Verona arrived 4 minutes down as well.
It's close to Carlos at the finish. You didn't mention it. But.
Yeah. Mm. And another thing I was about to mention is the fact that this caveat, this thing that is developing, right? Little Trek not being able to win a stage. They were second on Limone Piemonte with Ciccone, second on Charles with Mats Pedersen. Today they have their difficulties after a Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France in which they were able to gain so much success, right? In multiple ways, six stage wins at the Giro. They're struggling now, and this storyline of them not trying to win is one of the most interesting ones at the Vuelta now.
The storyline of them not trying to win?
Of
not succeeding?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is. And Pedersen, I mean, one thing that Carlos Verona, when I spoke to him after the finish, said was that it's certainly not the pressure with Mads. It's certainly not that Mads Pedersen is buckling under the pressure, because if there's one rider in the peloton in the world, maybe alongside Pogacar and a couple of others, Van der Poel, who rises to the occasion and who seems to relish pressure, it is Mads Pedersen. Just to go back to Turner for a second, Pellacci, interesting rider in the sense that in his neo-professional season, which I think it was 2022, had a really impressive season. And as often happens when someone does that, you know, you sort of project forward and you imagine that this might be, you know, one of the big classic stars of his generation. That hasn't so far been the case, but I talked a minute ago about how he seemed to have developed or found new strings to his bow, particularly in the last few months. And it's going to be interesting to see the way that he develops. He tends to race well in Spain. And one of his victories today was in Murcia, the Vuelta a Murcia. And he was also second a couple of years ago in the race in Jaén, the gravel race, which shouldn't be a surprise because he's a rider with a history, sort of a rich pedigree in cyclocross when he was a young rider. So, Pellacci, Salt Bay in red. We saw Christian Prudhomme here at the finish in Voiron visiting. He was in sort of, it was kind of dressed down, what day of the week is it? Tuesday, dressed down Tuesday. So Christian Prudhomme, he was more as a sort of tourist in a non-official capacity, just dropping in, but he had a nice, I'm sure it was a nice chat with Gaudu.
What do you make, Daniele, of the front page of L'Equipe this morning? They labelled Gaudu as Le Revenant. Is he, does it mean that he was away or something?
Well, he had a tough summer, didn't he? We talked about that yesterday. We talked about his disastrous Tour de l'Ain. And one of our colleagues actually this morning put it to him that he's inconsistent and he does run very, very hot and cold. And he sort of shrugged and laughed and said, well, I'm like that in life in general. Very mercurial character. Self-confessed sort of maverick, mercurial character, very, very up and down. And, you know, he's a rider who divides opinion with, you know, we know about his beef with Arnaud Démare. Alexis Brunel, the Total Energy rider, gave an interview earlier this year where he was extremely, extremely, well, scathing about David Gaudu. But I must confess that in our dealings with him, he's someone who's generally got a smile on his face and is generally pretty easy to deal with, certainly from the point of view of the media. But it's going to be interesting to see how he gets on in the rest of the world. But a huge fillip for Groupama to go into Spain with the red jersey tomorrow. How they're going to get on, well, we shall see, and we'll maybe talk about that in just a while. Of course, they've got Stefan Kung in their ranks. He'll be very useful tomorrow, but we'll talk about that a bit later. Pellacci, it's time for a bit of a cheat of an Encuentro del Día because it didn't take place today. It took place yesterday. We got one in the bank early yesterday. And this was in response to a story that had sort of made the rounds. Someone had picked up on these quotes from the Dutch rider Wout Poels, of course, multiple Grand Tour stage winner, riding here for Astana. And he was commenting on his friend and fellow, well, podcast co-host, Dylan Van Baarle's partner, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot's Tour de France femme victory and the controversy thereafter about her weight and the debate that this has created in not just women's cycling, but further afield in the sport in general. And Wout Poels was obviously quite aggrieved at how this issue has been spoken about, how much scrutiny Ferrand-Prévot has faced for this. So, Pellacci, before we hear from Wout Poels, is this a sort of frustration is probably the wrong word, but is this something that's also aggrieved you slightly, the way this issue has become a bit of a, we say in English, a hot potato, pon della discordia in Italian?
I did not like the way it was discussed most of the times, especially because weight, watt kilo, that little number, il rapporto, how do you say?
The ratio.
The ratio, yeah, is extremely important in cycling now. And if she gets down on weight, she does that with help, with the assistance of medical assistance, for sure. She has the freedom to do that. And we should not judge women and say, oh, she should have done this, should have done
no,
that.
No, I mean, I think what it's definitely brought into focus is the disparity in treatment and the way we all we all sort of tiptoe or not around these issues when they regard women as opposed to when they regard men. For example, at the Tour de France, I did an interview with Valentin Paris-Peintre when I asked him about his efforts to put on weight, because he talked to L'Équipe about how this is impossible for him. And in this interview for ITV, he then told me that, you know, he tried everything, Nutella and McDonald's and beer. And when it's about a man, we all tend to sort of laugh and think this is very funny and that there isn't any great jeopardy. It's just part of the, it's part of the sort of, it's kind of a colourful side story. When it is about women, obviously, and there are legitimate reasons for this as well, because, you know, women's health is different from men's health, but there is definitely a disparity in the way that we talk about these issues and the way that we react to these issues. And I think the discussion around Florent Prouvot afterwards has highlighted that. The other thing I would say, though, as well, is also highlighted to me how important it is to know the context in which people are speaking. We've heard, well, we've seen quotes from people like Marlon Reusser and other Demi Vollering as well, but there have been others. And these quotes, they just get seized, plucked out of context and circulated, often translated, often mistranslated. And it can be that someone is talking about, you know, Marlon Reusser, for example, when she said, we didn't want her to win because, you know, that would have put the, what she was sort of implying, that would put the pressure on the rest of us as women cyclists. It's almost important to see the kind of expression on Marlon Reusser's face when she's saying that. Is she joking, for example? I don't think that was the case in this particular instance, but context is also important, I suppose. Should we hear Paul's now, and then we might have a few closing thoughts before we move on. So today's Encuentro del Día, which wasn't today, it was yesterday, is with Wout Poels.
El Encuentro del Día, the meeting of the day.
Well, Wout, I'm going to ask you about the Vuelta in a minute, but first of all, I've seen some stories over the last 24 hours, derived from something you said on your podcast. I got it wrong a minute ago. It's not Dylan Van Baarle's podcast.
Together.
You were talking about Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, obviously Dylan's partner, and her winning the Tour de France, the weight debate afterwards. And you were slightly surprised, maybe upset by the way this has been discussed in the media. Just expand if you can.
Yeah, I just find it really sad that she has to... It was almost more about a weight than about a tour victory. And I think what we are doing, when you do top sport, you have to do certain things to become in a top shape. And if you do it in the right way, yeah, you also become... weight is also part of that. And I think they blew it really up for her. And she almost had to defend herself. And I think that was not really fair.
And you said that in your career, you often had people questioning whether you were healthy. You said when you were at Team Sky, people questioned whether you were anorexic. Just explain that.
It was not all the time, of course, but I had one time there was in a, I don't know which television program it was again, but they were also speaking about it. And I think you always have to be very careful with things like that. And it's also a little bit almost like body shaming if you look back to it, because we are not doing something... not eating, training really hard, and then go to the Tour de France, because if you have an eating disorder, you cannot do top sport. And then I think your whole life is around not eating, try to be skinny, and we do it with a whole different thing, just to perform well, just do it in a controlled way and not just try to be skinny.
I suppose the question is always, well, you said you have to look for the limits. Where are the limits? Where is that sort of razor's edge? What's healthy, what's not? And it's a grey area, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a really grey area, but I think what we are doing is not healthy anyway, top sport. I think sport in general is really healthy for your body fitness, but I think what we are doing 3 weeks on a bike with 40 degrees, I think is not healthy at all. So, yeah, you always have to try to protect everyone in sport, but you know, top sport is also a little bit different than normal sport, and yeah, if you do it in a controlled way, and of course in all the teams we have like expertise, coaches, nutritionists, so it's not, yeah, it's in a controlled area, and yeah, you try to find the limits, and that's how top sport works, and I think everyone want to become the best, and that's why you have to look for the limits, of course.
And in the course of your career, you've obviously been a pro for a long time. How have you seen the debate or an attitudes change to weight? Because there have been periods in the last 10 years when weight's been a huge focus. Then it seemed to become a little bit less of a focus. I mean, what's been the main sort of change in the way riders think about this issue?
Nah, I think also depends on what kind of rider you are. If you are the classic rider, you also still need to be skinny and on a good shape. But it's a little bit different. And if you are want to go for the high mountains and you're like, for me for example, I'm pretty tall, but my body shape is always a little bit more skinny, so for me it's a little bit more easier, but yeah, I'm not a classics guy, so I'm not gonna go, can weigh like 5 kilo or whatever on the muscle mass and suddenly do the classics. So you have to look what kind of rider you are, and that's where you go for. And I think the weight is always there, weight and power, that's, yeah, it's never changed. It was also in the past, it's also now, and yeah, it's part of the sport.
I promise to ask about your Vuelta a España. Just tell us, how are you feeling, and what are your hopes for this Vuelta?
Yeah, no, Vuelta is always a really nice race, so I'm really happy to be here again. Really hard course this year, but it always fits me, so I think there are a lot of opportunities to go for the break and try to get a stage win.
Flooring anniversary sale. We're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices with beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's anniversary sale. Right.
Pelacci.
Very good interview with you and Vote Polls, Daniele. Just, I liked your most recent soliloquy about context, and I have just to add more context. We read of Vote Polls and his remarks with anorexia on a piece on velooutsideonline.com by Jim Cotton. Go read that. It's really well done. Mm. Yeah, it's a... Go ahead.
No, I mean, and he talked there, well, and he talked in my interview as well, about how people almost accused him of being anorexic when he was at Team Sky. Now, that was a bit of I got the sense talking to him that in the period when people were making those accusations or suggesting things, there was probably also a subtext to that, and it was a time when people were suggesting, implying, accusing him and the rest of Team Sky of maybe doing other things, nefarious things. But certainly eating disorders in professional cycling, it's something that has existed in professional cycling for decades, no doubt about that. It's been written about extensively. I wrote a feature about eating disorders in professional cycling 20 years and I was far from the first person to do it. Anyway, Pelacci, lots to discuss on that. We could do a whole separate podcast, several podcasts on that. Pelacci, before we talk about tomorrow's stage, today we definitively left Italy. We were going to yesterday. We'll do it quickly now. A final verdict, please, on three and a half stages in Piemonte.
Well, first of all, let me say, sono molto triste. I'm very sad. I miss my country already. I miss my prosciutto. I must say, the first three stages plus a half were undertone, sometimes completely deludenti, disappointing, because, for example, we arrived in Novara. You think of Novara as a city that, not the most famous one in Piedmont. We were not in the city center. We started in Alba, not in the city center, in some random parking outside. The cities we visited were not the touristic main attractions of Piedmont, right? In a region that has the mighty Colle delle Finestre, the majestic Nivolé. I get it, they are huge climbs. Maybe the route was not going to be there, but you got smaller hills as well, like Colle del Lys, Europa, or the hills around Turin. Yeah. And yeah.
I must confess though, Pelaccio, we've had this conversation a lot over the last 48 hours or so, that when it comes to apportioning public money and spending public money on bike races, and we talked yesterday about this figure, that it's not a rumoured figure. The region of Piemonte itself has said that it spent 4.5 million euros on the Vuelta a España. I don't fully understand sometimes the logic of, well, what the money's being spent on and why. For example, Ceres yesterday, it is a dilapidated, really, mountain community. There is no prospect of Ceres being launched, relaunched as a destination that people from around the world are going to flock to. Then we mentioned yesterday the fact that the Vuelta a España was not being televised on Italian national television. So why there? Why on earth there? Yesterday, talking about leaflets earlier, the leaflets we get handed out. Yesterday we had a sort of press review of press coverage about the Vuelta coming to Ceres and the quotes from local officials. There was a quote from the mayor celebrating the fact that last year there were 8 children born in Ceres, and this was fantastic news because this community has been kind of dying to a certain extent. But then on the other hand, people are moving out of the big city Turin and going to places like Ceres, so there's maybe a sort of glimmer of hope for its future there. But what on earth is it doing in center stage of the Vuelta a España? And probably, in order to get something more than the kind of answers we usually get when we kind of do a 5-minute interview with this, you know, this type of official, mayors and public officials, you'd probably need to sit down with him for an hour or two to really pick his brains about exactly how did this work and why here and why were these choices made.
It's interesting. Can't you see people from Madrid moving to Ceres to escape the war and terror?
It sounded vaguely Spanish.
It does. In a press release by Regione Piemonte, they cited a study commissioned by University of Turin, according to which in 2024, the start of the Giro and the passage of the Tour de France through Piedmont had such a net economic impact that every euro, every euro invested generated about 8 euros. It's tough to separate. For example, are people from Spain coming to Piedmont next year because of the Vuelta a España or also because of the Vuelta? But Daniele, I was reading on our long car drive today, I was reading the press, the Italian press, right? I was going through the major Italian news outlets and discovered that what they were making of this Gran Salida from Italia. I must confess, it was a lot.
You're morphing into Ciro. Anyway, go on.
I must confess, it was a lot of bikes stolen and not much else was discussed. The Turin edition of Corriere della Sera went as far as calling it La Vuelta dei Furti. Huh. The Vuelta of the Thefts, probably.
Thefts, we've got to get this robbery. Right. Not robberies and not burglaries, thefts.
But meanwhile, general news in Italian media about cycling has been quite depressing. We've been hearing a lot about how 3 cyclists got hit by a car in Puglia in early August. All of 3 died.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I mentioned yesterday, my conversation with the press officer of the Piedmontese Cycling Federation, Ivano Garelli, and he said that, you know, he hoped that an event like this can at least, I don't want to say offset some of the bad news and the sort of disincentives for young people to ride their bikes, because there are a lot of disincentives for young people to ride their bikes in Italy, with, well, mainly the main one being these tragic accidents that we keep hearing about. I mean, Luca Vergalito, who's riding here for Alpecin, he was a good friend of
Samuele Previtera.
Yeah, who sadly lost his life in the Val d'Aosta recently. Yep. And there's been far, far too much of that in Italy.
But it's
recently.
Not like they don't have the recipe for things going better. Because, for example, the city of Bologna is now called Bologna Città Trenta, that rule that says inside the mura of the historical center
inside
of Bologna,
walls, yeah.
You cannot go faster than 30 km per hour. And guess what? 1 year after that rule change, Bologna has had zero death of people on the bikes and pedestrians. So that's really good. I've got one little last thing. I'm going on a bit of a rant here with several bullet points, but it was strange to me to see how... So the governing body of the region of Piedmont is on the right. Of course, the government in Italy of Giorgia Meloni is on the right as well. There was not an agreement and, you know, a little accordo to make the Rai...
Italian television, yeah.
Yeah, transmit the Vuelta on national television. Maybe I have to say also that touristic spots, very famous touristic spots in Piedmont, possibly did not want the Vuelta there because could have stopped other touristic activities. Similar to what happened to a recent edition of the Milan-Sanremo in August, they said tourists going to the sea are more, you know, they get more money than the Vuelta, so we don't want the cycling race here.
Pelacci, we're going to have to wrap up pretty quickly, but just before we get to tomorrow's day, I'm just going to mention, because I forgot yesterday, talking about, well, tragic events, unfortunately, in cycling. One was narrowly avoided in the Vuelta a España in 1994 in Salamanca, and that was the subject of my Guía Las Gorras, the daily history lessons I'm doing on my Strava, to do with the Vuelta a España, and that story involved the Mario Cipollini in, as I said, Salamanca in 1994. A story with a... not really a happy ending, but fortunately Cipollini, well, he wasn't as seriously injured as he could have been, but that will resume, I think, when we go running tomorrow, Pelacci. I think we've got tomorrow down, based on where we're staying, I think we've got tomorrow down as a 3-star running day. We give every day, it's already all laid out, all set out, sort of altitude gain is going to be on every run. I think tomorrow's a 3-star day, so you'll be looking forward to that.
La etapa de mañana, la cena de ayer. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's food.
Pelacci, tomorrow's stage starts at the Salvador Dali Museum. I mentioned a few days ago that I've been sort of frantically looking for Salvador Dali links with cycling. We established that. There were some. One of the more offbeat ones was shared with me by our good friend Fran Reyes, who's at the Vuelta a España, unfortunately not working for us this year, working for a team. And he talks about a recent novel that came out, El Tour de Francia y las Magnolias del Dr. Jekyll. The Tour de France and Dr. Jekyll's Magnolias. The novel's main plot follows a journalist searching for a missing cyclist set during the Tour de France. How does this relate to Salvador Dali? And that's a very good question. And to be honest, I've got a summary up here and I'm not entirely sure.
We are doing this so live.
Hey, we are doing this. Anyway, Salvador Dali, he drew a postcard for the 1959 Tour de France. And this appears in the book. And Dali was also a big fan of cycling, particularly Louis-Saint Bobet. We talked about his quote the other day, when bicycles arrive in Paris, summer ends. He described watching the tour while painting as deeply satisfying, almost sensual experience. I don't know how that relates to the original novel, but maybe I'll have the answer to that tomorrow. Anyway, Pelacci, team time trial tomorrow.
Road cleaner are coming at taking our beers, but tomorrow's stage will be 24 kilometers long, completely flat, from Figueres to Figueres. It's a clockwise loop with two time checks in Cabañes and Villanova de la Muga. From what I can tell from the planimetry map, it's a pretty mixed parkour with long straight as well as more technical sections. I like this reintroduction, stable reintroduction in La Vuelta of team time trial. When the last TTT happened in the La Vuelta a España. Team DSM Firmenich won. They are now Team Picnic Postanel, of course. Lorenzo Milesi wore the Mayor Rojo for one day, but he was not the last Italian to wear it, Daniele. You remember who was?
The first Italian?
The last Italian to wear Maglia Rossa.
No, I don't remember.
It was Andrea Piccolo.
Ah, what's become of Andrea Piccolo? Is he under investigation still?
No, bro, he has joined his girlfriend on OnlyFans.
Oh, yes, I did know that at the time.
Interesting.
Anyway, that's a whole other podcast. That is a whole other podcast. And Pelacci, we're not going to discuss this in too much detail because we'll fall into the realm of speculation. I would like a prediction, though, from you. Who's going to win? Which team is going to win tomorrow?
So we talked about how Little Trek is hungry for wins at this Vuelta España. They might do it with Dan Hule and Mats Pedersen as very good time trialists.
I would say on paper, Visma Lisabike and UAE Team Emirates have the best time trialists, and I am going to predict that UAE will win. Not only that, Pelacci, now I think this is a bit of a long shot. But if they do win, it is not beyond the realms of possibility that Juan Ayuso will be in the red jersey tomorrow. There are all sorts going on around us. In fact, it probably is beyond the realms of... No, it's not. It's not, in fact, because Juan Ayuso is currently the best placed UAE Team Emirates rider. So even if he finishes with his co-leader, Joao Almeida, which you would expect to be the case tomorrow, if they finish 16 seconds faster or 16 seconds ahead of Visma Lisabike and Jonas Vingegaard, then he could be in the red jersey tomorrow. And how convenient, Pelacci, because we are going to play out tonight with a little chat, a very short chat I had with Juan Ayuso this morning about the team time trial tomorrow and his hopes, expectations for that. Pelacci, we'll be back tomorrow from Figueres.
We will. Hasta mañana.
Hasta mañana.
Now, we did train quite a lot the 2 days before the water started when we were all together.
Yeah.
But at the end, it's quite a hard discipline to train because we're never the team that's racing together. And, you know, back in December, you really don't know who's going to be at the end racing. So it's hard to prepare. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's the same for everybody. In team time trials, you can get a big difference because the speed is so high that if, you know, you do it well and another teams don't, the difference in speed is much higher than in the normal TTT. So yeah, it's an important day. I mean, on my side, I just take it day by day. You see the rivals already feeling good. Not the same for me, but yeah, I hope I can keep getting that race pace in and just see in the coming days.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices with beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale. Right.